Appreciate what Hunter had to say about Psalm 19. It's a special passage to me, too. Being from Texas, it's just not as pretty as Kentucky in certain parts. I mean, there are parts out west that are pretty cool, but it's not as pretty as Kentucky. But what we have in Texas is sky. From horizon to horizon, you can see it all around and the clouds and everything. We have lots of sky and lots of stars, and the heavens declare the glory of God. And man, you almost can't help but think about God when you look at how gorgeous it is and how majestic it is. And I love this passage. I mean, a few years ago, I was on a little mini retreat down to the Abbey of Gethsemane, and I always try to memorize the passage when I'm there. So I try to memorize Psalm 19. I memorize Psalm 19. Try to memorize in the NIV, which is a hard thing to do. It is hard to memorize the NIV because it just sounds like everyday language. It's easier to memorize like the Revised Standard Version or the King James or something that has a little more flair than the NIV. But I memorize the NIV, and it's so meaningful to me, the whole thing. The first six verses, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Every time you look up, they're pouring forth speech. There's no speech. Night after night, they display knowledge. There's no speech or language, or their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words to the ends of the world, talking about the glory of God. And then this vision of the sun almost being like a racehorse, you know. In the heavens, he has pitched a tent for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming forth from his pavilion, like a champion, a racehorse rejoicing to run his course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is hidden from its heat. I love this. Psalm 19 and other passages like Romans 1 claim that creation itself testifies to the existence and glory of God. And there are many science-based arguments for the existence of God. Intelligent design proponents offer many impressive arguments, I think, based on the latest advances in biology and other sciences. And these arguments caused a huge stir among scientists and philosophers as they began to be developed and promoted. And they seem to have really touched a chord, which is seen clearly in the extremely passionate attacks on intelligent design by atheistic scientists, but also by the defection of one of the world's most prominent atheistic philosophers, who's been convinced by this evidence that's uncovered by the Human Genome Project in particular to switch sides in the debate. He now argues for the existence of God because he was the head of the Genome Project and it convinced him. Have you ever thought about how many different ideas there are about faith and religion, ideas about the existence of God in the human race? There are Christians of a variety of stripes. There are Hindus, there are Muslims, Shiites, and Sunnis. There are Confucianists, Shintoists, Buddhists, Baha'is, atheists, agnostics, nihilists, humanists, deists, pantheists, and New Agers, and every one of them thinks he or she is right about this issue. They all think they're right. And a lot of people are going to find out when they die that they're wrong. Maybe all of them, but at least, you know, maybe some of them. I don't know. But thoughtful people, that raises a question. What are the odds that I'm right? So many people with so many different ideas and opinions, why do I think I'm right about it? That's a troublesome question. About 150 years ago, a British mathematician and philosopher named William Clifford wrote an essay called The Ethics of Belief. And one of the statements that he made in that essay was, "It is always wrong everywhere for anyone to believe anything on the grounds of insufficient evidence." Although he didn't say it directly, what he's really writing about was faith in God. He was really saying a lot of smart people out there disagree with each other. There's no way to know who's right or who's wrong. So the only appropriate response is just don't decide. Don't commit. Don't be an atheist, but just be an agnostic or a skeptic. At about the same time, late to mid 1800s, mid to late 1800s, another man named William James, who wrote a response to Clifford and said that there are some situations where that skeptical agnostic approach is not wise, it's not smart. He said in particular, when it involves a situation that has these three conditions, the choices that you're facing are one, live, two, momentous, and three, forced. The first condition of all, live. You have two options, either option's plausible. You can't prove either one, but each is a possibility. For example, in May, I'm supposed to have cochlear implant surgery. Will it substantially improve my hearing or will it not? My surgeon says either potentiality is possible. So that's a live option. It could be one, it could be the other. But if I were to consider whether my hearing will substantially improve without the surgery, that is not a live option. That's a dead option. It'll not happen. So I'm going to have the surgery because at least it's a live option. And sometimes you have two options that are not only live, they're also momentous. In other words, the options are not like vanilla or chocolate or foam or no foam on your latte. The stakes are really high. For example, that overused TV trope, do you cut the red wire or the green wire to defuse the bomb? And James says, sometimes you're forced to make a choice between two situations where abstaining neutrality, withholding a commitment, is not really an option. To choose not to make a decision is to make a decision. Red wire, green wire, the timer's counting down. You have to cut a wire and you have to do it now. It's forced. Is it one or is it the other? You're either going to be alive or dead. You can choose one or you can choose the other, but there's no third ground. So we're talking about faith and doubt. And sometimes people think about faith and doubt as if it's kind of an abstract issue. A philosophical question, and they can remain neutral and not really make a choice. But the truth is, you only have one life, and it's short. You have a choice, so you have to decide the answers to these questions. What will I build my life on? What will my character be based on? What cause will I serve? What legacy will I leave? These are all God questions. Whether we want to think of them that way or not, they're all God questions. This is not the kind of issue where I can just stand on the sidelines and say, well, I think I'll take a pass on this discussion. If you just drift, then practically you're an atheist. And practical atheism is its own decision. I believe the greatest opportunity ever offered to a human being is the opportunity to trust Jesus, to know Jesus, to learn from Jesus, to follow Jesus, to love Jesus. I think that's it. That's the biggest decision you can ever make, I think. And I believe that life and death, heaven and hell, hang in the balance. For you, for me, for our neighbors, for people who live here where we are, for people all over the world. In this message, I want to tell you a few of the reasons why I believe that faith in God, in particular faith in Jesus, makes sense to me. And the first is, I believe the way people argue suggests that God exists. And this idea, I didn't come up with. I read about it from a guy named C.S. Lewis. How many of you have heard people arguing or have actually engaged in an argument yourself? Well, that would be everybody. You don't have to raise your hand, of course. We all argue. Now, here's what's interesting. In an argument, nobody says, agree with me, do what I want, because I'm smarter and stronger and a better arguer, and because I can force you to do what I want anyway. No one appeals to that. When people argue, even avowed atheists, here are the kinds of things they say. I do way more than my fair share around this house. Or he got a bigger piece of dessert than I did. He got a bigger allowance. He did fewer chores. He got a later curfew than I did, and it's not fair. Not fair? You're a miserable boss, and this is a dysfunctional sweatshop, and I'm grossly overworked and criminally underpaid. According to what basis? C.S. Lewis writes about this in Mere Christianity. When we argue, we say things like, that's not right, that's not good, you're not being fair. In other words, we appeal to a standard that is independent and objective and higher than you and me. We appeal to the idea that there is such a thing as right and wrong, and you're wrong. Based on what? Now, many people in our day claim to believe that right and wrong are subjective, just preference, like chocolate or vanilla. You have yours, I have mine, everybody's different. And in our society, we often hear or read about people saying, don't impose your beliefs on me. I agree, that's a bad thing to do. Don't do it. God doesn't even do that. But isn't it interesting that they don't say, don't impose your geometry on me. Don't impose your chemistry on me. Why not? Because we assume that science and mathematics are about objective reality. So we don't think they can be imposed on us. They just are. But we often believe that morals and values are simply subjective preferences. You have yours, I have mine. It's all just arbitrary. But every time you hear two people argue, it shows that we really know better. We believe that moral reality is built into the way that life is. It's part of the fabric of the universe. That's exactly what Paul was writing about when he said in Romans 2, verse 14 and 15, indeed, when Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature things required by the law, they are a law for themselves, even though they do not have the law. Since they show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts now accusing, now even defending them. On what basis? Every human being knows two things. We know there is a way that we ought to behave. There is a code, a standard, and we might be fuzzy on the details of it sometimes, but we have a general idea of what it is. We know there's a standard that we all ought to live up to, and secondly, we all know that we don't live up to that standard all the time. We fall short. We need forgiveness. We need grace. We need to get fixed. Every time people argue, they're implying that the universe is not an accident and that there is a moral order and that there is a law of right and wrong that's just built into the way things are. Because it was put there by somebody, and that somebody was God. The good news is that God is a gracious God. That's part of why I believe in God. Every time you argue, I think it's evidence for the existence of God. Second reason, I believe the existence of human beings, of personal creatures, argues for the existence of God, our very existence. Human nature is such an extraordinary thing, unprecedented in the entire universe. Writer and theologian G.K. Chesterton said that one of the reasons that he became convinced about Christianity is because it captures the fullness and the mystery and the contradiction and the paradox of life, especially of persons. G.K. Chesterton says that when it comes to human nature, there's some approaches like Stoicism that are kind of pessimistic about human nature. Don't get your hopes up. Don't expect too much. Then there are some approaches, certain forms of humanism, that teach man is the measure of all things. They have an exalted, optimistic view of human nature. When it comes to human nature, Christianity is not just pessimistic or optimistic or blandly middle of the road. It is wildly pessimistic. Jeremiah 17, verse 9, the heart is deceitful and wicked above all things. It is also wildly optimistic and hopeful. Like 1 John 3, 2, dear friends, now we are children of God. And what we will be has not yet been made known. It crafts all this truth and wonder and mystery and darkness and potential for goodness in the human condition. Naturalism says that human beings are just a collection of atoms. Some people believe that Darwin proved that human beings are different in degree, maybe, but not in kind from any other creature. The Bible, however, says that we are a different kind of being, that we are made in the image of God. In our hearts, I think we know this is true about ourselves. For example, why don't we ever put an animal on trial? When somebody's bitten by a lion, somebody gets mauled by a bear, we don't put that animal on trial. We may put it down to protect other humans, but we don't sue it. We don't take it to court. We don't just say, that's nature. What we just say, that's the nature of a bear. That's the nature of a lion. You can't really place guilt on them because they're just doing what's natural to them. But human beings, we do put on trial because we know they are not just products of instinct and training, that they have reason, they have freedom, they are moral agents, they are culpable. Animals are not culpable for the bad things they do. Human beings are culpable. We are responsible. We all know it. What's at stake here is nothing less than the notion of personhood, that there's something wondrous and mysterious and God-breathed about, and holy even, about a person. A person ought not be enslaved. Materialism or Darwinism says that people do not have a moral nature. They are not free. They're just products of causes and forces. They're products of natural selection. It's just that we don't know all the details yet. We haven't figured out all the details yet as to why we are the way we are. But nobody raises a child like that. Nobody makes a friend like that. We know better. The existence of persons, I think, tells us that there is a God. Another reason, when you look at persons, they all have this drive to have a purpose, to have a meaning, to have significance. And I believe that our drive for purpose is another evidence for the existence of God. Everybody you know, no matter what they say or claim about the afterlife, God, spirituality, everybody wants a way of life that has meaning, that has significance, that has purpose, and we do all kinds of things to find those things, to feel that way about ourselves. When it comes to making a choice, if you ask whether a choice is rational, we're looking at whether a choice to commit to God is rational. Every choice has two components to it. One part of the choice is I have to have certain beliefs, but then another part of making choices, I have to have a purpose, an intention, and a desire. For example, if I come to a fork in the road and I want to go to Cleveland, and I believe that this road will lead me to Cleveland, then I will make a choice to go down that road. Now, if you ask, is that a rational, reasonable choice? Then I'll have to look at two questions. First, is my belief rational? Is it rational to believe that this particular road is going to lead to Cleveland? And then the other question is my purpose rational? Is it ever rational to want to go to Cleveland? That's a whole other subject. I think it is, because they have baseball games there in Cleveland, and sometimes the Texas Rangers come to play. So that's a good reason to go to Cleveland, or they have that Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. That's awesome. So I think it is rational to want to go to Cleveland. But here's the thing. Atheism, materialism in general, would say that you can analyze the rationality of someone's belief, that it might be rational, it might be irrational. But they would say when it comes to purpose, there's nothing about rationality connected with our purposes. Purposes are not rational or irrational. They're just whatever anybody wants to do. There's nothing about the universe or the nature of reality that says anything about whether one purpose is better, worse, truer, or more false than another one. I don't agree with that. Whatever your purpose is, whether it's greed, pleasure, status, or kind of an eat and drink and be merry for tomorrow we die kind of purpose, whatever it is, that's your deal. But in our hearts, we know better. We know that not every purpose is the same. In our hearts, we know that to give our lives to unworthy causes is not just unsatisfying, it's also irrational. It's not fitting. We all know this. What that means is we all know at some level we're not accidents. We're made for a purpose. That's why we have a hunger for it. That's why every time I see a fish with legs emblem on the back of a car, I smile. I think it's hilarious. It's ironic. These opponents of religion are more religious than most Christians, thereby proving they're not just a higher form of animal. But I believe that to ask God to help you to know and fulfill your purpose is infinitely wiser, infinitely saner, infinitely more rational on the notion that the universe than to bet your one and only existence on the notion that the universe is a random accident that does not care whether you are noble or evil, whether you live or die. Those things don't matter. I don't think to bet your one and only life on the notion that the universe doesn't care if you're good or evil, I just don't think that's smart. Another reason why I think betting your life on God is the sanest thing you can do is I believe the existence of joy points toward God. Sometimes people think what we really want more than anything else is we want to be happy. If you ask folks, what's the number one desire of the human race? The answer would probably be happiness. And we say we want to be happy above everything else. I don't think that's true, and I'll tell you why. Let's say there was a pill that if you swallowed it would put you kind of into a permanent coma. And in this coma, you would be guaranteed to have thrilling dreams. You would have uninterrupted surges of happiness. If you took that pill, you would have pleasure, delight, and joy forever. You would be asleep. You'd never be in touch with anybody. But you would have never-ending happiness. Would you take that pill? No. Of course not. We wouldn't do that. Imagine you could plug your brain into an outlet and it would stimulate your pleasure center forever so that you would feel great pleasure throughout all eternity, but you would never do anything. You would never go anywhere. You would never know anyone. Would you do that? No, you wouldn't do it. It would be a nightmare if someone did that to us. Because what we want is something deeper than pleasure. We want joy, not just happiness. Joy, although we love it, always points us beyond ourselves. What we want is that to which joy points. We want joy in beauty. That's why some scenes, a mountaintop, the ocean, music, sometimes pierces our hearts, gives us a feeling of joy. We want joy in getting lost in a great cause that sets things right and brings happiness to others. We want joy in a person. There's always a desire, an ache, a stab of pain in joy on this earth because everything tells us, not yet. Not yet. No human joy satisfies. I believe our chronic hunger for joy tells us that we've been cut off from the reality for which we were made. And that reality is God. That's why there's this restless bondage to joy in our world. That's why the greatest joy that's ever been written about or sung or praised is what the Bible calls the joy of the Lord. The joy of the Lord is not that you're happy when you go to church, or when you're singing hymns, or when you're quoting Bible verses. It's a joy that will come one day when you are not broken, when you finally see face to face, clear as a bell, that for which you were made. That secret longing that you've carried within you like a wound your whole life long will be met. That's the joy of the Lord. You cry for that joy. You ache for that joy. You long for that joy. Once there was a man who had that joy. People saw him. People knew him. One time he said to his friends in John 15, "The reason I tell you these things is so that my joy might be in you and your joy might be complete." Our quest for joy, our search for joy, our broken, messed up, obsessive, endless pursuit of joy tells us that we were made for the joy bringer.